Apologize for the delay. Council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, please, the court. There are two issues certified on this appeal. The first issue is whether $10 code 4001 constitutes a waiver of sovereign immunity in this case involving allegations of gross negligence where the state has not provided for any insurance coverage. This court has documented in its opinions that the sovereign immunity of the state of Delaware has been a principle of every Delaware constitution since the Constitution of 1776, over 300 years. The very argument the plaintiff asserts in this case has been repeatedly rejected by this court and the Superior Court since at least 1985 in the Supreme Court case of Doe v. Cates. In 1985, this court succinctly rejected the same argument the plaintiff makes today. We find no merit to this contention. The court went on to say, quote, we hold that the legislature did not intend by enacting $10 Code 4001 to waive sovereign immunity in all cases where a ministerial act was performed with gross or wanton negligence or in bad faith. Appellant's interpretation reads much too much into this limited statute and would expose the state to liabilities that would not otherwise exist. The holding of Doe was confirmed again by this court in Turnbull v. Fink. And most recently in the Pauley case, this court en banc rejected plaintiff's argument and affirmed the holding of Doe v. Cates specifically, quoting the same above passage that I just quoted. The court in Pauley said, even if a jury were to determine on remand that Reinhold, who was the defendant in that case, grossly negligent act caused the injuries to the Pauley plaintiffs, the state would still not be open to unlimited exposure for their loss. Plaintiff's argument that the legislature intended to waive sovereign immunity for every possible claim for which the state has not provided insurance goes against 300 years of constitutional law. It goes against 20 years of Supreme and Superior Court precedent since Doe v. Cates. It goes against legislative intent because the General Assembly is clearly aware of this court's ruling since 1985 in Doe v. Cates and has made no attempt whatsoever to enlarge its liability. And finally, it defies common sense because it turns the concept of sovereign immunity on its head. The concept of sovereign immunity is except where the General Assembly specifically waives the immunity of the of Delaware taxpayers, that immunity is intact. And plaintiff's argument is that unless the state has enacted an insurance program, then the state is open to unlimited liability. That's opposite to the whole concept of sovereign immunity. And as this court's aware from the many cases that have come before it, there is very little insurance coverage out there, unfortunately. The coverage essentially is for motor vehicles of the state, and it's also state troopers are insured under an indemnity policy that in large part is due to the fact that the state troopers have insisted through their union that they have coverage. Many other areas of the state, all the areas that plaintiffs suggest the state should be exposed to unlimited liability would be open. This doesn't make sense. It defies common sense because the General Assembly would not intend to expose the state taxpayers to that unlimited liability in all the areas that the state is involved in that are high risk. For example, prisons. Plaintiff's argument would be that this legislative intent is that in prisons, that any time a prisoner files a lawsuit, if he alleges gross negligence, then therefore the state coffers are open to unlimited liability. It's difficult to reconcile that with legislative history, with the history of the court, with the history of the state of Delaware and its constitution. Plaintiff's argument that the Mental Health Patients Bill of Rights was a waiver of sovereign immunity is clearly erroneous and cannot be reconciled with this court's en banc holding in Pauley. That act is directed specifically at medical facilities in general, not state facilities. It provides for equitable relief, not monetary relief, There is no mention of damages anywhere in the statute. Then enforcement is invested in the court of chancery, not a court of damages. And most important, there's absolutely no language that could possibly be construed as a specific waiver of sovereign immunity in that statute. In Pauley, this court did not find that language in the emergency vehicle statute waiving governmental immunity was specific enough to waive sovereign immunity. And in that case, Chief Justice Steele wrote, it is difficult to conceive that the General Assembly would remove a cap on the state's exposure to damages without specifically indicating an intent to do so and without referring to 18 Delaware Code Chapter 65. Certainly that the mental health statute does not contain either of those. And I would point out that the mental health statute in this case was extensively amended in 1995. So this is not a case where we have a very brief statute that perhaps is not as explicit as it could be. This is a lengthy statute that was amended at great length in 1995. So if the legislature, if the General Assembly's intent were to waive waive liability for monetary damages, it surely would have been included, as Chief Justice Steele wrote. The second certified question before the court today is whether an action for money damages may be maintained against the state and its agencies pursuant to 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. For the purposes of monetary damages, the state and its employees in their official capacity are not persons subject to the statutory language of Section 1983. The law on this issue is also unmistakably clear. 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 is a federal statute, and the United States Supreme Court in Will v. Michigan Department of State Police in 1989 held in that case that the state is not a person for the purposes of Section 1983 monetary damages. Plaintiff below has produced no authority to the contrary. The U.S. District Court for the District of Delaware, the Third Circuit, and the Delaware Superior Court are all in agreement. This issue has not reached this court, I think, because the law in the case is so plain and no court below has had difficulty with it. The Third Circuit case cited by the plaintiff in this case, Rochester v. White, a 1974 case predating Will, actually supports the appellant's argument in this case because it dealt with prospective injunctive relief and pointed out that monetary damages were not available and talked about prospective injunctive relief. And that issue, just like the monetary damages issue, is not in dispute under the case law. A state can be drawn into court for prospective future injunctive relief, but not monetary damages. Plaintiff then begins to discuss the difference between the 11th Amendment argument and the person, not a person argument. 11th Amendment applies to whether or not a state can be hailed into federal court to answer. And the 11th Amendment prevents that. But in state court, the 11th Amendment is not as applicable. And that's why the language of whether or not the state is a person under the statutory construction of Section 1983 becomes far more significant. The defendant has argued that the mental health bill is also a waiver of the 11th Amendment. And the case that he cites in this, in Rochester v. White, says regarding that, quote, in deciding whether a state has waived its constitutional protection under the 11th Amendment, we will find waiver only where stated by the most express language or by such overwhelming implications from the text as will leave no room for any other reasonable construction. And certainly there is no suggestion of any waiver of the 11th Amendment in the Mental Health Bill of Rights. As I said, plaintiff confuses the 11th Amendment issue with the not-a-person issue. The not-a-person issue under Will is an issue of statutory construction decided by the United States Supreme Court based on the statute's language, the traditional definition of person, the congressional purpose, and legislative history. The other issue before the court, or actually not before the court, is official capacity versus individual capacity that that plaintiff below raises as an argument. That issue was not addressed below. It's brought out in with regard to his argument on 42 U.S.C. section 1983 and the not a person argument. And in this particular case, there has been no argument, if you look at the complaint, that these people are being sued in their individual capacity. The officials are only identified in their official capacity. The plaintiff did not make any distinction among the individuals or between the individuals and the actual state agencies. There's no allegations of individual action or negligence. For individual liability, you have to have individual action. It's not a respondeat superior if you're suing an individual. The fact in this case, the tragic fact that has been brought out by the plaintiff below, as well as the court, is that there was an individual who was on suicide watch. It's undisputed that there was suicide precautions in place. It appears to be from the record, or at least from the plaintiff's allegations, that there was a delay in checking on that patient, that rather than being checked on a 15-minute interview, the nursing staff did not respond to check until 15 minutes after that, so a 30-minute gap of time went by. But the interesting thing about this fact, which the court and the plaintiffs have brought forth, is that nursing staff are not part of this case. They're not sued in this case. The only people that are sued are upper-level officials. So when we look at the facts of this case, they don't mesh with the defendants in this case. They were sued because they are the officials that they are, and not because of any individual action. Unless the court has any questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. I would like to start with a little bit of factual background because I think it's important with regard to the applicability of the mental health rights statute. This is a patient of my client who had a job, was married, was raising a family, had several episodes where she attempted to commit suicide, ends up being brought to Meadowood, and at that point in time she's civilly committed, ends up in the Delaware psychiatric unit. While she's there, she has one episode where she attempts suicide. There are protocols which are in effect at the institution that say that once the patient reaches that status, there are certain protocols that we have to follow, and that is that we have to monitor these patients on a one-on-one basis. We have to do that at a minimum every 15 minutes. After this attempt within the unit, there were numerous references throughout the medical records about continued thoughts, suicidal ideations on the part of Ms. Washington. The allegations in this case are that, that monitoring did not occur, and as a consequence of that failure of the monitoring in this case, she took her life. And there is a claim on behalf of the estate as well as the family for that. The reason why that factual background is important in this case, I submit to you, is that the legislature, when it enacted the Mental Health Patient Bill of Rights, was intending to address the types of issues that we are dealing with in this particular case. I've submitted in the briefs, that the waiver in this case occurs by the enactment of that statute by the General Assembly. And let me step back and just take a moment to talk about what that statute really means and what it addresses. The suggestion was made in the argument that this statute doesn't have anything to do with the state of Delaware. In fact, if you look at the statute, definition section talks about the department. And when they talk about the department, they're talking about the Department of Health and Social Services. Also within the statute is reference to, which is in subsection paragraph 14, it talks about actually the Delaware Psychiatric Center and its obligations. There's no question that the legislature intended this to apply to the state of Delaware, and in particular to the Delaware Psychiatric center. It's important to consider this statute in the context of what the legislature was attempting to do when it enacted this legislation. They have set forth obligations in the way in which one needs to treat patients who are in psychiatric centers, distinct from patients who come to hospitals for emergency care or for other medical reasons. And why is that different? Why is that distinct? The reason why it's different and it's distinct is that many people who end up in the psychiatric centers are not there on their own free will. They're there because they have been committed either by some mechanism of the state or a local agency or by a loved one. And those individuals are then in a setting in which they are then in a psychiatric institution, and the legislature said we need to protect those individuals who are there in those circumstances. I suggest to you as well that if one were to look at the whole world of patients who were admitted into psychiatric centers here in the state of Delaware, a significant portion, if not the most significant portion of those individuals, are patients who are in state facilities. So when the legislature enacted this legislation, they were intending to cover patients who were admitted to our state psychiatric centers, and including the one at issue in this case. The code and the statutes which I have cited as part of the argument in this case talk about the obligations and the rights that patients have. They talk about the necessity for continuity of care. They talk about the need for safety. They talk about the need for monitoring. There's a section within the statute that talks about as well that facilities that do not provide adequate staffing, and that they have had violations within a two-year period, that those institutions are responsible in the event that they have a situation that causes some safety concern.
Let's assume all that's true and that the statute provides for injunctive relief with jurisdiction in the Court of Chancery. And let's assume that gross negligence occurred in this case, and then let's address the certified questions. Where in the statute does it suggest that when the legislature enacted it, that the legislature intended that there be a cause of action for money damages against the state, and that the state explicitly waived sovereign immunity protection from a claim for money damages?
Well, the enactment of the statute, I submit, if you look at the Tort Claims Act, it talks about there being either an express waiver or if it's interpreted as a matter of law as a waiver, and I submit to you that the court, looking at this case, can say that the legislature intended to have a waiver if you were creating these rights and obligations.
What's the difference between an express waiver and interpreted as a matter of law?
If you look at the statute and you say you have created an obligation to patients in the state of Delaware, to the patients that will have this obligation for certain types of treatment and rights that they have, by doing that, they have created obligations which I contend are obligations that are incumbent upon the state and not simply non-state.
Let's accept that.
Okay.
And then doesn't the statute say if the state, for example, isn't carrying out those obligations, injunctive relief will lie, the state will be restrained from continued activities that are inconsistent with those obligations, and perhaps even a mandatory injunction that instructs the state to modify the way in which it's delivering services to be consistent with the statute. But my question is, where does the legislature say, to the extent the state does not do so as a result of gross negligence on the part of its employees, that a cause of action for money damages will lie, and we explicitly waive any protection otherwise afforded by the doctrine of sovereign immunity?
The statute talks about there being injunctive relief and also some jurisdiction with regard to the Chancery Court. I cited in my brief on...
Well, that's the only place you can get injunctive relief. That might be the reason they mentioned the Court of Chancery.
Well, they did. But there's also language that talks about... if I may just have a moment. To simply argue that this statute only permits injunctive relief would limit the statute itself. In other words, it would, if you're limiting the statute to say that this only permits injunctive relief that the Chancery Court could step in and then argue or do something about, would eliminate a significant problem or issues that deal with patients. Let me give you an example. If a patient is being treated in a fashion in which they are in violation of these rights, and that patient is being caused some harm, those patients, one would argue that you could get injunctive relief. That would be your only relief that would be available. In this case, I'm alleging and arguing that, in fact, there were violations that no injunctive relief could deal with whatsoever, because my client lost her life because of these failures in this case. So to look at the statute and to say that the only thing that it does is to grant injunctive relief, I submit to the court, is not the interpretation of this statute. That included within that statute and the intent of the statute is to have a cause of action that can be addressing issues that are...
So you're not looking solely at the State Tort Claims Act as the basis for an action for monetary damages. You're saying there's one within this Mental Health Act?
Yes, Your Honor. And what I argue is that there's actually, on page 24 of my brief, I address the issue about whether there simply is just injunctive relief available, because I believe there are money damages available. I did not cite a case, but there is I've become aware of actually another pending matter that has addressed, at least in some form, the fact that this statute would permit money damages, compensatory damages, as part of the recovery. But I did not cite it in my brief, and I was not going to argue that here today. But there is other case law which addresses that precise issue. So,
well, wouldn't it be helpful to, isn't that exactly on point?
Yes, it is. I have a cite, but I didn't know whether I'd be properly permitted to make that argument here.
Well, I think it'd be worthwhile to know what it is.
Case is Community Legal Aid Society versus McConey, and it is it's an opinion from Vice Chancellor Jacobs, which addressed the issue about equitable relief relative to this statute. I have a Westlaw site, which is 2002. WL 1466593, and in this in the case the issue, there are a number of issues involved, but one of them addressed the issue of whether a group could come in on behalf of a patient and assert certain rights, and there was a standing issue, and the court, Chancery Court, talking about this case, mentioned the fact that the interest for the estate, in that case it was a death case, that their interest would be a claim for damages, and that's where their remedy would lie in discussing this statute. So the statute, I believe, was discussed in that context. And again, I go back to the...
Was there a discussion of sovereign immunity?
I don't believe the issue of sovereign immunity was discussed. This had to do with standing for bringing the action, and there was an issue about the state officials who were named in their official capacities, but the actual issue of the sovereign immunity was not precisely discussed. But this was we're talking about a statute where there's not been much substantive case law which has developed from it, but again, I go back to the legislative intent, which was to create...
Let me stop you there, because I would think, I could be wrong, but I would think that at this point, given the wealth of authority from the courts with respect to sovereign immunity and how only an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity will operate as a waiver, that the General Assembly, if it were inclined to provide certain rights that included the right to seek money damages against the state, would say so in so many words. And yet you're asking us to add that intent into a statute that doesn't say so in so many words. Isn't that inconsistent with what our case law holds?
No, Your Honor, I believe when they were talking about the patient's rights and the enforcement relative to the Chancery Court's obligations, on page 24 of my brief, I mentioned that the enforcement rights were set forth in 16 Delaware Code 5162. And then it says, notwithstanding 10 Delaware Code 342, the Court of Chancery shall have jurisdiction over all actions requesting declaratory relief. And then that statute was actually amended in 1995, and the legislator added the words, notwithstanding 10 Delaware Code 342, which was which that section, which is actually part of the statute, when it talks about the Chancery Court having the equitable relief remedy, the way this is worded now, it says notwithstanding, then talking about the Court of Chancery, the notwithstanding means that in addition to the court, that there is also under 10 Delaware Code 342, it says adequate remedy in other court. It says the Court of Chancery shall not have jurisdiction to determine whether determine any matter wherein a sufficient remedy may be had by common law or statute. And in this case, the way, if you read those together, that it's saying the Chancery Court has the equitable ability to deal with this type of problem because sometimes it involves equitable relief. But the remaining remedies are not really within the jurisdiction of the court because they're not equitable. And I believe that that's what the Community Legal Aid Society case that I was citing is. The court's saying, well, we can do equitable things, but if you want to pursue a claim for damages on behalf of the estate, that's something we don't have jurisdiction over because we are a court of equity. And I believe that those read in conjunction do permit a recovery of damages under the statute.
So your argument would be, because the Court of Chancery doesn't have jurisdiction to award monetary damages, and because the statute suggests that that's notwithstanding a statute where an award for monetary damages may be found in another court, that that's an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity, so people could sue the state of Delaware and recover against the state for monetary damages arising from a cause of action out of the mental health statute. Is that correct? Somewhere, somehow, that doesn't sound like an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity to me. That, in fact, to be fair, it doesn't sound explicit at all.
Well, my explicitness in terms of the argument is just to go back and look at what the legislature was intending to do. And what the legislature was intending to do was to enact legislation to protect a class of citizens.
Yeah, well, but the issue in the certified questions is, did the legislature explicitly state an intention to waive sovereign immunity so that people could bring claims against the state for monetary damages when, in fact, there was a violation of the statute?
Right.
Explicit to me means express language that says this is so.
Well, the certification, as it was worded, came up with that language, but if you look at the State Tort Claims Act and you talk about where there is immunity, because that, in essence, is statutorily how you determine what immunity is. If you look at the beginning part of the statute, it says 10 Delaware Code 4001, it says, except as provided by state law. And in fact, the language in the very beginning of the paragraph says it doesn't use the word expressly. In fact, it goes on, says...
Well, but there's the little problem of many cases from this court saying it has to be expressed for it's a waiver of sovereign immunity.
I go back to the argument, in essence, that this was an intent, an express intent to waive that. In essence, what we have in a case like this, and just in terms of the breadth of it, we are only talking about patients who are in psychiatric institutions. I'm not arguing for any immunity that loss that is beyond that. We're talking about this class of patients. The legislature took this step to create rights relative to this class. And in essence, if the state's argument stays as it is and they are correct, then that means that patients who are treated in non-state facilities can pursue causes of action, and patients who are treated in the same fashion in a state facility have no remedy as a matter of law available to them, none whatsoever.
Is there something unusual about that, given the factual basis of every other case we've ever decided involving sovereign immunity in accident cases or other negligence cases?
Well, I understand that...
Look at Paulo. An unfortunate result based upon the state's policy judgment, but we don't make those policy judgments. The legislature does.
And my argument is that this is a case where the legislature intended to create rights relative to this group, and that this group, in essence, is you have a statute that's going to give a right to some individuals.
Well, how can the court understand how you're using the word intended? If we look at a statute, we never look at the intent behind the statute unless the statute's ambiguous. So are you using the word intent, that if we look at the statute, it's ambiguous, but the intent was to do something? Or are you saying the statute is unambiguous, and if we read the plain language, we find an express waiver of sovereign immunity?
I don't believe the statute is ambiguous. I think it's clear what it intends to do. I know my time is up, but
you can finish answering Justice Holland's question.
What the statute is, what the statute does is it creates an express right, and I submit an express remedy under the statute for the reasons I've set forth in my brief and I've argued previously. Those express statements are not a matter of interpretation. I believe that creates rights relative to an entire class or group of patients, and in that context, I believe that there is an express waiver.
Well, obviously, the difficulty we're having is we need to go back to Marbury versus Madison for your remedy, because what you're saying is that they created a right in the statute, and since Marbury versus Madison and before, it's been held that you can't have a right without a remedy. But as the Chief Justice said, we have to read that into the statute, and how do we find an express waiver that provides that remedy without reading it into the statute?
For the reasons that I argued previously about the jurisdiction, in other words, it's the way, if you look at the statute with regard to the Chancery Court's jurisdiction, and the way the language is together with notwithstanding, and then talks about the jurisdiction of the Chancery Court, that those two together, read in their logical form, would indicate that there is not only an equitable remedy, which would address these circumstances, but also a remedy as a matter of law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm somewhat at a loss in addressing the Court of Chancery case because it wasn't a case that was briefed below. However, because our office was involved, although I was not personally involved, I had some passing knowledge of it. And that Court of Chancery case involved an estate that sued and also Classy. And the principal issue is my recollection of what was before the court in the Court of Chancery decision was whether or not Classy had standing, and they addressed that. But previous to that decision, the estate had been dismissed out. And in dismissing the estate out, I pointed out that a remedy of the estate was not injunctive relief, because injunctive relief for a deceased person was unavailable, and that if it had a claim, it would be one for damages, and dismissed it. So actually that case proves the opposite of what plaintiff is attempting to argue in this case, that the Court of Chancery had that opportunity to accept the case and say, your client is deceased, therefore she can't get equitable relief. However, we have authority based on this statute to have a damages action, and the Court reached the opposite conclusion.
Let's look at the statute, and let's suppose that you're in a state facility and you have a documented history of trying to commit suicide, and the state isn't monitoring you very closely because you've got this long history of trying to commit suicide. You just haven't been successful yet. Would a patient have a right to go to the Court of Chancery and get an injunction that said, probably through their guardian, we have a right under the statute to be monitored a little closer, and we shouldn't have these attempted suicides week after week, in my hypothetical. The only reason we're having these continued attempts is because the monitoring is not proper. Therefore, we're entitled to injunctive relief whereby proper monitoring is ordered.
And it does, this statute does provide an individual and Classy, in this case, which was Judge Jacobs holding, the right to go in and ask for a mandatory injunctive relief to perhaps increase staffing levels to do something else that may help this situation, but it does not. And under any circumstances, you can't read a damages action into this.
No, I understand, but you're anticipating my question. So you agree, if you're suicidal and you're not being monitored and there are repeated attempts to commit suicide, you'd be entitled to injunctive relief. But if you successfully commit suicide, that's just unfortunate.
In that the circumstance the court has given, it certainly would be unfortunate, but that would be the law as the legislature has passed it. And as the court has pointed out, there are unfortunate circumstances that take place. There are unfortunate circumstances that the law doesn't remedy. People are victims of crimes every day, and it's terrible when that happens.
Well,
but that isn't something that can be remedied.
Let's suppose there was a chancery order in place that said monitor the patient, and it was disregarded, and the person successfully commits suicide. Does that change anything? You're just held in contempt of court?
It would depend. I believe that Your Honor's factual situation you've set forth is somewhat vague. There would certainly may be certain remedies if an individual was ordered to do something, somebody was grossly negligent in performing that duty as an individual, that individual would be personally liable. So there are possible remedies depending on how that factual situation played out. But to read in a right to a damage lawsuit into this statute, I think, would be beyond the intent of the statute.
Now, I'm just trying to understand how the statute operates from the state's point of view.
Well, and I'd like to go at it from the other side, which I think maybe Justice Holland was alluding to. Let's assume that someone is successful in getting injunctive relief that involves increasing the staffing in order to provide the level of care that's mandated. And the state fails to do that and comes back and says, we don't have the money for it. You can't force us to do that because that would, in essence, be requiring the state to spend money, and it would be tantamount to waiving our sovereign immunity.
Well, I think that issue has certainly that collision of the branches of government has happened, and certainly in federal court with regard to constitutional issues, and the court has prevailed on being able to force the state to spend money for injunctive relief. And exactly in a 1983 case, that's the remedy that's available. You can't sue the state in federal court for damages. You're not allowed to do that. It's the same situation. However, in federal court, you are permitted to force a state official in his official capacity to follow the prospective injunctive relief of the court order. So this is not an unusual situation.
Okay.
Moment, Your Honor. I would just reiterate that the statute that the court has pointed to, or the plaintiff has pointed to. On appeal, I would note that that was not raised below, but on appeal, we've addressed that the statute clearly does not address any waiver of immunity. As the court has pointed out in its recent opinion, that waiver would be far more explicit if the General Assembly actually had that intent.
I noticed that in the order on motion for re-argument, the trial judge said the ruling in Pauley is inapplicable because there's no state insurance coverage for the allegations in this case. And I understand from the order there was no oral argument, so you might not be able to answer this, but do you have any idea why she concluded that Pauley would not be applicable in this case?
I don't know.
Other than the factual distinction that there's no insurance in this case?
It's a difference. I think it's a difference, a distinction without a difference in this case. It is, if you look at, I believe the court's reasoning was that Pauley dealt with a situation in which there was insurance, and over top of that, there was no insurance, so the state addressed that, and somehow believed that if the state addresses this or does not address it at all, that somehow that would be a waiver. It goes directly against Doe v. Cates, and as I said in my principal argument, it really turns sovereign immunity on its head. The idea that in instances where the state believes there should be some insurance, there's no waiver above that, but in instances that the state believes that insurance isn't even appropriate, that somehow then we open the state coffers.
That
makes
why,
no sense.
That's why I asked the question, because many times I've heard and actually litigated the argument an eon ago that if the state does provide insurance, the mere fact the state didn't provide enough, that the provision of insurance constitutes a waiver of sovereign immunity. We've dealt and ruled with that. But it's difficult for me to understand a rationale that says Pauley doesn't apply when there's no insurance available at all. I just didn't get it.
I have the same trouble, Your Honor. I believed that it defied common sense. I mean, it is a legal niche that you can go into, but it just makes no sense to me. And
you're almost out of time, and this has raised one potentially important question. I seem to recall seeing something to suggest that there may actually be a question of fact as to whether there is any insurance coverage. Is that a matter that's up for grabs, or is that clearly not the case?
That is not an issue, I believe, that's before this court. The parties approached this case from the outset that there was no insurance coverage. The parties agreed to it, and in fact, it says in the court's opinion below that the parties agree that there's no insurance coverage. Plus, Your Honors have been through enough of these cases to know that we have been through these cases for years. People have often wanted to discover and see if there's insurance coverage. There is an insurance coverage. If there were insurance coverage for the state hospital, I believe this court would be aware of it. And there isn't.
So you're representing that, as a matter of fact, there is no insurance coverage.
We are representing that in the court record is an affidavit of the state insurance coverage office that was undisputed by anyone below, not disputed by the parties, not disputed by the court.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.